In its quest to provide an open forum for discussion of controversial issues, this station allows hosts and their guests to express themselves without any significant censorship. You're advised that any views expressed by the hosts or their guests are not necessarily the views of Tug Entertainment or its partners.
Welcome to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com. And hosted by editor-in-chief of Officer.com and 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Officer Radio is your source for the latest news, trends, and issues facing the law enforcement community. Join us each week as Officer Borelli and his guest examine, dissect, and discuss the issues facing our industry. Call in live and join the conversation to get your voice heard. Now, let's get to it. It's Officer Radio, live with Frank Borelli on Officer.com.
Good day, and welcome to Officer Radio on Officer.com. I'm Frank Borelli, the editor of Officer.com and your host for today's radio show. Today we'll be talking about several topics ranging from the birthday of the United States Marine Corps to the history and evolution of Special Weapons and Tactics Teams, otherwise known as SWAT, in the United States. Throughout the show, we'll be taking calls from listeners. The number to dial is 866-404-6519. That's 866-404-6519. If you have a comment, question, observation, or other thought to share, please don't hesitate to dial us up. If for any reason you're uncomfortable calling, feel free to send me an email. The email address is frankborelli@officer.com. No dits, dots, dashes, or spaces, all one word, FrankBorelli at officer.com. Please call or send me an email if you have anything you want to share or question to ask. I'll see if I can find the answer. I'm real good at saying I don't know, and I'll look it up. If that's the case, you'll hear me typing avidly on the internet in the background as I try to find your answer. Today's show, like all of them, will be archived on the Officer.com radio page as well as our podcast page. We kicked off the show. The first one was September 8th. On September 8th, we talked about the 10th anniversary, the 10 years that had passed since the attacks of September 11th, 2001. On September 15th, we did a show called Honoring the Fallen, and we talked to folks at the memorial, some other people who do what they can to keep the memory alive of those who have made the ultimate sacrifice in the line of duty. Shows like that are archived both on our radio page and on our podcast page. They make some good listening sometimes when you need a reminder of the risk that officers take and the sacrifices that they make in the line of duty. So to find those for reference or future listening, just go to officer.com. On the top navigation bar, click on the Media Center. In our Media Center, on the blue navigation bar, you'll see a link for Officer Radio right next to the link for the podcast library. I encourage you to bookmark them and come back. We're adding a new one every week, and the material is valid and valuable, and it's a good resource in my opinion. Of course, it's my voice, so I hope to think it's a good resource. I'd hate to think I'm wasting my time. The archive shows are also available on iTunes, so you can search us out there to download them. Hopefully, as you know, well, as you hopefully know, Officer.com has a Facebook fan page and a Twitter feed. Any updates we plan for the radio show, scheduled guests, etc., will be posted and tweeted accordingly. And, you know, as a 30-year law enforcement veteran, it sounds funny for me to say we're tweeting something, but welcome to today's world. Please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Not only do we appreciate the interaction, but it allows us to serve your information needs better. Now, with all of that admin stuff out of the way, let's get into the meat of the show. As I mentioned earlier, today's the United States Marine Corps' birthday. On November 10th, 1775, a gentleman named Samuel Nicholas stood up two battalions of Marines, I believe. He had been tasked to do so by the Second Continental Congress on November 5th, 1775, and he was the first commandant of the Marine Corps. He did that in Philadelphia, and he stood up those two battalions as naval infantry, is what they were called at the time. Since then, obviously, the mission of the Marine Corps has changed. It's changed because of military doctrine as that's evolved, and because of foreign policy as that's evolved. But they've been around for 236 years, so happy birthday to the United States Marine Corps. For those of you who know me or have ever spoken with me, you know I honor the Marines a lot. I'm not a Marine, I never have been, never will claim to be until I can go through Marine Corps boot camp and earn the right to call myself a Marine. And at this point, I'm too old. They won't take me. I might be able to challenge them when I hit 52, and then I'd be the oldest person to ever complete Marine Corps basic training. The oldest to date was 51, according to my son, who is a Marine. So son of mine, Nicholas, happy birthday. His wife is also a Marine. Jessica, happy birthday. She's deployed at the moment, and we keep her in our thoughts and prayers. I have four older brothers who are all Marines. I myself happen to have been in the Army, which is an older branch of service, and I like to rub that in my Marine Corps friends' faces at times. A little bit of inter-service rivalry that's all in good jest and good fun, and we pick on each other. But the Army was born in June of 1775, so we're 5 months older than the Marine Corps. You know, it is what it is. We have a good time with it. The Marine Corps, the Second Continental Congress created or issued that order commanding Samuel Nicholas to form those two battalions of Continental Marines. They did so in a place called Tun Tavern, and I find this an interesting piece of American trivia because of everything that happened in Tun Tavern. Located in Philadelphia, Tun Tavern was built way back in 1685 by a guy named Samuel Carpenter. It sat at the corner of Water Street and Tun Alley in Philadelphia. And Tun is spelled T-U-N. Time, Union, Nora, Tango, Uniform, November, depending on which phonetic alphabet you're going to use. The name Tun Tavern was a play on words relating to the tavern, both to the alley it sat next to, because it sat next to Tun Alley, and the fact that the old English word tun, T-U-N, was what we called a beer container, those kegs that beer came in. So this was a tun sitting on the corner of Tun. And much later after it was built, 60-some-odd years after it was built, a restaurant was added. So the Marine Corps was born there. Tun Tavern's no longer there. It's my understanding that if you drive up northbound Interstate 95 through Philadelphia, you will drive right over where Tun Tavern used to sit. I think it's a shame that we destroyed a national landmark. Both, you know, the First and Second Continental Congresses were held there. The Marine Corps, the Army were created there. The Navy was created there. Our country essentially was created there. It's a shame that it's no longer there. I've been to a place in New Jersey, in Atlantic City, called Tun Tavern. It is there to honor the Marine Corps. It's not the same. So, little bits of trivia there for you. Tun Tavern, corner of Water Street, and Tun Alley. And Tun Tavern served a lot of other purposes as well for you history buffs. Not only was it the Marine Corps' birthplace and the Army's birthplace and essentially the country's birthplace, Benjamin Franklin used it as a recruiting station for the Pennsylvania Militia. It was used to stand up a number of nonprofit organizations that still are alive today, to include the Freemasons and St. George's Society, St. Andrew's Society, a bunch of different places. Like I said, it's a shame that we saw fit to destroy it rather than honor it. So going back to where I started, the United States Marine Corps was born 236 years ago today. Happy birthday to all of our United States Marines. I understand there's a tradition at every Marine Corps base at the Chow Hall at a certain time. They're going to cut a cake to celebrate the birthday, and the oldest Marine at hand gets the first piece, and the youngest Marine on hand gets the second piece of that cake. And if I'm wrong, if there's a Marine out there listening to me and that's incorrect, call me or email me and let me know that I'm wrong and give me the correction. That's how I understand it. It's been passed to me from my family members that are Marines, and I think that's an outstanding tradition. I think that's really cool. You know, they say once a Marine, always a Marine. I used to refer to Marines who were no longer active duty, but so they were civilians now. They were out of the Marine Corps. I used to refer to them as former Marines, and I've been corrected. It's my understanding that the current commandant of the Marine Corps has already said this repeatedly. There's no such thing as a former Marine. Once you're a Marine, you're always a Marine. The only time you're not is if you're an ex-Marine, and those are people who were dishonorably discharged and therefore lost the privilege of referring to themselves as Marines. So, one more time, happy birthday to the United States Marine Corps. Thank you for all you do. Ronald Reagan said, and I'm paraphrasing, there are a lot of people in the world who have to worry about whether or not they ever make a difference. The Marine Corps does not have that problem. United States Marines don't have that problem. Thank you for what you do. Speaking of thanks and people in the service, tomorrow is Veterans Day. And even though we wish the Marines a happy birthday today, we can't forget every other branch of service. Like I said, I was in the Army. In my family, piece of trivia for you, you never wanted to know. In four generations of my family, we have 33 service veterans. I'm an Army vet. My father was in the Air Force. My grandfather came to this country, fought in World War I for the United States Army, and that's how he earned his American citizenship. My oldest daughter is an Army vet. My oldest boy gets out of the Marine Corps next week. And my youngest son, I don't think, can wait to put on a uniform. He's already participating in the Civil Air Patrol. Tomorrow is Veterans Day. Those who have served, those currently serving, and those who have sacrificed their lives while serving our great nation should never, ever be forgotten and should never, ever be taken for granted. Yes, this is a radio show for officer radio, for police officers. About two-thirds to three-fourths of every police officer I know is a service veteran. They've been there, or they still are, in the reserves of the National Guard or some other form. You know, whether it's Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard, and some people will argue with me about the Coast Guard. During times of war, they get deployed and they fight to defend our nation. As far as I'm concerned, they're a branch of service. We need to thank every one of them. If there's a veteran in your day, be it a friend, family member, coworker, teacher, student, whatever, if there is a veteran in your day tomorrow, you need to take the time to shake their hand and say thank you for your service. If there's a Marine in your birthday today, you need to say happy birthday. Now, we're going to come up on our first break here shortly. When we come back from our first break, we will talk a little bit about the history of Veterans Day, and then we're going to get into SWAT and the history of it, the evolution of it, what that acronym really stands for, because when it was originally put out, it was not meant to be Special Weapons and Tactics. It was meant to be something else, as it was developed in L.A. by LAPD. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about how the mission has changed, what missions remain the same, how it's become more difficult, so on and so forth. I encourage you, if you're a SWAT officer listening, to give me a call in if you have a contribution to make, 866-404-6519, or send me an email, frankborelli@officer.com. When we get back, Veterans Day, evolution of SWAT. Talk to you in just a couple seconds.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. In May of 2011, a small brown-eyed boy proudly showed off the law enforcement buttons he had pinned to his shirt in honor of his dad, an officer killed in the line of duty 6 years ago. Then the reality set in. This boy was just a few days away from his sixth birthday. He never got the chance to meet his dad, nor did thousands of children whose parents' names are forever etched into the living memorial in Judiciary Square. Join us in 2012 as we launch Officer World Expo in Washington, D.C. in our effort to reduce the intolerably large number of officers who didn't get to go home to their families. OfficerWorldExpo.com, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
I am not the woman I used to be. I'm Free with Minister Diane Jones, Monday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet. This is your chance, ladies, to hear stories of hope and healing from someone who's been there. Someone who has fought back from the horrors of incest. Minister Diane's innocence was stolen from her in the land of alcoholism and mental illness, which led to her being emotionally, physically, and sexually abused by her parents. Yet in spite of this trauma, she has gone on to become a successful wife, mother, registered nurse, and minister of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm not the woman I used to be. I'm Free is a straight-up show to enlighten you and to lighten your load. Do not let the weight of this world or the things that have happened to you control your life. For more on the show and Diane and her book, The Story of Me, email her directly from her show page here on TogiNet. Then, join us for I'm Not the Woman I Used to Be. I'm Free with Minister Diane Jones, Monday nights at 10, 9 Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
All right, folks, welcome back. When we went to break, we were talking about Veterans Day. As a service veteran, like I said, I have family who are service veterans. It's actually how the Borelli name earned American citizenship in the United States in 1919. I have a deep and abiding appreciation for every service veteran. I want to thank them all for what they do, the sacrifices that they've made, and the service that they've given. For everybody that is serving today, you will one day be a veteran. Thank you very much for everything that you're doing to protect our great nation. Now, for those of you who didn't know, Veterans Day wasn't always called Veterans Day. It's been celebrated as Armistice Day, forgive me, first day with a new tongue, Remembrance Day in other parts of the world. November 11th was the anniversary of signing of the armistice that ended World War I. It's come to mean something more with Veterans Day and us really trying to appreciate everything that they've done. President Woodrow Wilson first proclaimed Armistice Day in 1919. And then in 1926, Congress passed a resolution requesting that President Coolidge issue another proclamation to observe November 11th. And that was approved in 1938. We used to celebrate Armistice Day. And it went on and it evolved and became Veterans Day. And I'm not going to beat this. It's holiday in the ground. We could talk about it for the whole radio show. You know, Veterans Day should mean something to everybody, just like Police Memorial Day and Police Memorial Week. There's a group of people in our country who, as they say, they've put their hand in the air and they've written a check up to and including the value of their life to serve their country. And they've stood behind that to make their word good and their oath good. And one day soon, we're going to have a show on from an organization called oathkeepers.org and the value of that oath and what it means and what we've all done and said. From one veteran to all the other veterans out there, thank you very much for what you've done and what you continue to do. Now, let's get into the stuff that might be of greater interest to some of the law enforcement officers listening, the history of and history and evolution of SWAT teams. Now, and as my radio, the show producer and I were talking offline, everybody knows that SWAT, S-W-A-T, stands for Special Weapons and Tactics. That's not originally what it was, though. When it was first developed, historically documented, the first SWAT team was established by Inspector Daryl Gates of the Los Angeles Police Department in 1968. Excuse me. Now, we're going to talk about an incident that occurred in 1966, which helped to kind of give impetus to the development of SWAT. But it was originally – SWAT wasn't Special Weapons and Tactics. It was originally Special Weapons Assault Team. You know, we had things going on in our country, like we had rioting. If you think back and you look at where the United States was in the late 1960s with civil rights being the battle that it was, unfortunately, it was a battle. It should have been a given, being the battle that it was, with riots being the way they were, with what today we would call domestic terrorist organizations such as the Black Panthers being what they were, with various incidents going on around the country, there came a need for specialized teams. I mean, prior to the development of the first SWAT team, if you were a patrolman and you were presented with an issue, you had to come up with a solution. If you had a barricaded gunman, you had to pick whoever were your best shots and the bravest guys, and you had to go kick in a door and neutralize a threat. If you had a hostage situation, you know, maybe you call in the FBI for help or you call in somebody else for help. But the bottom line was still there was no specialized group of people, no team that had different equipment, better equipment, better body armor, armored cars, you know, everything that they have that we typically associate with SWAT teams, you know, submachine guns, assault rifles, breaching shotguns, riot control agents, stun grenades, sniper weapons, APCs, night vision, all the cool stuff. We used to say the cool guy, black Velcro, hut stuff. And it still is. Velcro, we've discovered, doesn't work so well because when you pull it open, it makes noise. And if you're in a noise discipline area, that's bad. But, you know, they didn't used to exist. And then in the 1960s, 1968, were developed in response to the need. Now, the one incident that I look back at that really calls attention to it for me was, you know, Charles Whitman and the Texas Tower incident is how it's commonly referred to. You know, August 1st, 1966, at the University of Texas at Austin, Charles Whitman killed 16 people, wounded 32 more on and around the university's campus that day, August 1st, 1966. He was a well-trained marksman, and as much as today's the Marine Corps' birthday, and we don't want to put any kind of negative slant on the Marine Corps, that's where he learned to shoot. He was a United States Marine. Who had developed some mental and medical issues that, for whatever purpose, drove him to kill. I don't make excuses for a murderer. If you murder, you murder. He was a mass murderer, having killed 16 and wounded 32 more. But the situation itself, the Texas Tower incident, was resolved when two police officers, Austin Police Department officers Ramiro Martinez and Houston McCoy, three, and Jerry Day, and a civilian, oddly enough, Alan Crum, reached the tower's observation deck and had to breach the door that had been barricaded by Whitman and make entry and neutralize Whitman, which is a very polite way of saying they had to shoot him until the threat was removed because he wasn't surrendering. You know, they essentially made up a SWAT team. Four people got together, made a plan. They approached under fire using cover as best they could, cover and concealment. They made entry. They breached a barricaded door, engaged the suspect, and neutralize the suspect. That's what a SWAT team does. They just weren't called SWAT yet. They weren't part of a team that was formed and organized and had a command structure and all the cool equipment, all the necessary equipment. They just did what they needed to do. In 1968, when Gates at LAPD decided he was going to create a SWAT team, and the name Special Weapons Assault Team was thrown out. You think about what those four men at the Texas Tower did. They assaulted a position using their courage and the weapons they had at hand. But when that's looked at, and we call Special Weapons and Tactics, the only reason we do that, I mean, think about this. We're politically correct in almost everything we do, and even way back in 1968, Gates had enough common sense to realize that you know, the general public might not like it too much if the police departments were building assault teams. So rather than having a special weapons assault team, we ended up with special weapons and tactics teams, which is a good thing. I mean, we have teams that do what they need to do. They face risks that other police officers shouldn't have to, aren't trained for, whatever. You know, we may have to. Things have changed for us across the years, and they've changed for SWAT, and we talk about the evolution of it. But when SWAT was born, if you will, and I hate to say born, I like to say hatched, because it's not like SWAT was born in L.A. and then it grew out from there. When the team was developed in L.A., and then there was teams that were developed on the East Coast, and there was teams developed in the South, and teams kind of cropped up all over the place. So they wasn't born and then evolved. They were kind of hatched across the country. And as a result, the tactics that were developed were different from the East Coast and the West Coast. The weapons of choice, different from one team to the next team. What they all had in common was the kind of people that they selected to build those first teams. In the area I grew up in, the first SWAT team was developed in the 1970s. And I know some of the men who were the original SWAT officers of the agency that I'm talking about. Most of them were military service veterans who had seen combat in Vietnam. They were mission focused. They were compassionate, but they weren't hesitant. If the trigger needed to be pulled, the trigger needed to be pulled. If the situation could be resolved without taking a life, then they would prefer to do that. They understood the value of life, and they understood the meaning of having to take a life if that's what it boiled down to. But they would do whatever they needed to do to accomplish the mission within the confines of policy and rules. But at the time, policy and rules for SWAT teams were still being developed. You know, if something had to be different, they would make an argument for the better way to do it. That was just how they were. And I'm honored to call some of those men friends of mine. They were a unique group of individuals. When you look back, it was 1970s. This is 40 years later. They're obviously no longer – that original team has evolved. They've been replaced by other men and women of courage, of capability, of competence, who have taken everything that they learned across that 40 years and continue to develop it. They, you know, when we look back at Whitman, the Texas Tower incident, we look at the original impetus, we look at SWAT being born. It changed how patrol officers do their job when we created SWAT. No longer did patrol guys have to face a risk. The SWAT people would show up and do it. SWAT officers would show up and do it. All the patrol guys had to do was set up a perimeter and contain and report. Essentially, all they had to do was sit, wait, and talk, if you think of it that way. It's a whole different term for SWAT. It applies to every patrol officer out there. Sit, wait, and talk. They would show up, sit on a perimeter, wait for SWAT to show up, and talk. They'd give reports. Oddly enough, I know a few SWAT guys who feel like their job sometimes is to sit, wait, and talk. Only they don't do the talking. The hostage negotiator guys do the talking. The SWAT guys get up, get there, get their plan made, get in position, get on a perimeter, make their approach, do whatever they need to do, but they hold their assault, they hold their action until it's either initiated by a bad guy or till the hostage negotiator says, you know what, I failed miserably, you're our best option, do what you got to do. We're going to pick up there when we come back after our next break. If you want to call in, 866-404-6519. Talk to you after the break.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these. Mark Lipinski is coming to TogiNet. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski. A live two-hour show Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on TogiNet.com. Creative Mojo. It's fun, entertaining, informative, inspirational, and illuminating. Lipinski has worked on such shows as Oprah, The View, The Joan Rivers Show, and Ricky Lake. He's busy, but he's got the drive to share with Creative Mojo, dedicated to the modern crafter and crafting lifestyle. Dive into the info and enjoy everything from celebs to entertainment news to recipes, quilting and needlework, knitting, painting, woodworking, Christmas crafts, and so much more. This show boldly encourages you to discover and harness your own creative spirit by living creatively every day. For more on Mark and the show, check out marklipinski.com. Don't miss the fun. It's Creative Mojo with Mark Lipinski, Wednesday afternoon starting at 3, 2 Central on toginet.com.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. Join thousands of other law enforcement professionals attending Police Week, May 12th through the 17th, 2012, in Washington, D.C. The new Officer World Expo at Police Week will offer training, conference sessions, and networking opportunities to better equip those who protect others. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by editor-in-chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
All right. Good afternoon and welcome back. We're talking about the history of SWAT and how things have changed. And this is what happens when I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing. I closed a window that I didn't mean to close, and now I've got to get it back open so I have my research material in front of me. But history of SWAT, you know, it changed how patrolmen do what they do. When a patrolman gets a call for a situation that becomes a barricaded gunman or a hostage situation, they set up a perimeter. They call in other units. They coordinate containment. They report. That's the sit, wait, and talk. SWAT units start to arrive. They get briefed. Team commander starts replacing units on the perimeter, patrol units on the perimeter with TAC guys or SWAT guys on the perimeter, and they start making their approach. They get their plan in effect, everything that they need to do done. And then they get to sit and wait while the negotiators talk. So we have two situations where SWAT actually means sit, wait, and talk. And I actually learned that from a SWAT team commander, but it applies to the patrol guys as well. And that's how we did business from 1968, essentially, when the SWAT was first developed. Until, you know, back in the day, and I've talked to some officers who were offended, some of the patrol guys who felt like, wait a minute, I'm a cop. Part of my job is to protect lives and save lives. And now you're telling me I get on the scene where I can do something, but I'm not allowed to. I have to sit here on a perimeter and wait and let these other guys come in and take all the credit and all the glory and do all the work. Isn't it funny how we say, take all the credit, take all the glory, before we say, do all the work? Those guys are going to show up and take all the risks. They're going to minimize their exposure to risk by exercising good plans and using good tactics, and maybe the specialized weapons play a role. But they're going to enter a situation where the average patrol officer should be happy not to have to go. I know I'd rather not if somebody else can take that risk, and if time permits it, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit as well. Time is a fickle thing. But so from the development of SWAT, 1968, the first launch of first team out in LAPD, until 1999, that's how we did business. Patrol would show up on the scene of a high-risk incident, set up a perimeter, sit, wait, and talk. In 1999, something changed. And if you guys remember what changed, it was an incident on April 20th, 1999, in Littleton, Colorado, called the Columbine High School Massacre, what it's usually referred to as. Two high school students who decided there's too many people in the world, they needed to take some of them out before they took themselves out. And on that day, the police officers who responded to the shootings did exactly what they were trained to do and exactly what their policy dictated that they do. They responded, set up a perimeter, called out SWAT teams, made the necessary notifications, reported regularly. They did everything that their training and their policy, their procedures from their agency, their general orders, everything said they should do. That's what they did. As anybody in law enforcement knows, the public outcry thereafter was over the top. I mean, they wanted the sheriff criminally charged. They wanted every officer's badge. The public that we serve did not understand why a police officer sat outside in a position of cover while children inside were being hunted. And it's an entirely reasonable response to our action. Although our brother cops did what they needed to do according to their training, their policies, and their protocols, there's a higher imperative, the moral imperative that we have when you take an oath to protect and serve. You know, sometimes you have to do something a little bit outside the box, a little bit outside of the training, a little bit outside of the policy and the protocols. And I'm not encouraging anybody to break the rules. But, you know, one of my favorite – couple of favorite lines from movies, and I hate to cite a Steven Seagal movie because I used to be a fan of his and I'm really not that much anymore. But he was in a movie where he's given some orders to stay out of a situation, and when his command structure got a hold of him and found him in the situation – you know, they said, hey, I can see you've completely ignored our orders. And his response was, well, you can court-martial me if I live. And amen. You know, training and policy and protocols are all important, but what do you do when children's lives are at risk and you have the opportunity to save one of them, two of them, 10 of them? What are we supposed to do? We certainly can't sit and wait and talk. Again, I'm not being critical of those who responded to Columbine. They did what their training policy and protocol said to do. Thank God we've evolved past that now with active shooter immediate response protocols that mandate patrolmen, patrol women, anybody in a uniform that's a police officer, a law enforcement official that shows up on such a scene to form a hasty team, make entry, and try to neutralize the threat. That's what we need to do to protect lives. That doesn't allow us a lot of time. Earlier we mentioned time and how it's fickle, and it is. Law enforcement, by and large, has become very, very much a risk management, mitigating risk, minimizing risk, reducing insurance costs. And thank God I'm not the chief of police in one of these agencies that's huge, like, or any other agency for that matter. But yeah, I can't imagine the decisions that have to be made by these chiefs of police in places like L.A. and D.C. and New York, Baltimore, Chicago, Philly, pick a place. And any NFL city, those people have got to have some of the best stress management techniques in the world, because they have to balance doing the right thing in a timely fashion against risk management and budgetary concerns. And I wouldn't want to do that. I wouldn't want to do that. Time, when it comes to minimizing the threat to life, we don't want to have a lot of time. I mean, time's great if you're in place, no shots are being fired, it's a barricaded gunman, it's a hostage situation. If your SWAT team's in place, ready to go, ready to execute at a moment's notice, and your negotiator thinks he's making progress, the time is a beautiful thing. But if you've got people pulling the trigger and lives that are being lost, you can't go fast enough. And we're going to talk about how readily that was demonstrated as well. But at Columbine, we learned a lesson. We had to change how we do business. We can't any longer simply set up a perimeter, contain things, and wait for SWAT to arrive. We have to take more timely action. Now, oddly enough, just like in the late 60s, when patrol guys got upset because SWAT teams might be stealing the glory, whatever, I heard SWAT officers in the year 2000, when I went to my first active shooter instructor course, complain that patrol officers were taking work away from them, and was this a foretelling of the reduction of SWAT, or were we going to remove our need for SWAT? Well, heck no. Patrol guys, the average patrol guy, is still not going to deal with a barricaded gunman or a hostage rescue situation, or in certain cities like the area I live in, my SWAT, local SWAT team, has to know how to board ships and seize control of them. They have to worry about maritime operations. They have to worry about hazardous materials operations. I mean, there's so much more that SWAT teams do beyond the immediate neutralization of a shooting threat to a group of people. It's one little tiny piece. It's not a threat to anybody except the police officer who took that oath, pinned on that badge, the deputy who took that oath and pinned on that star. Those people who took an oath to protect and serve and then find out after the fact that they don't actually have the courage to do it. And make no mistake, it takes a special and unique kind of individual to have the courage of their convictions. It takes a special and unique individual to run toward the sound of shots when everybody else is running the other way. It takes a disciplined, motivated, special and unique individual to move past injured people, suffering, screaming people asking for help, to move to the threat, to neutralize the threat, to accept the risk, to accept the incoming rounds, and to have the outlook, one bullet fired at me is one bullet not fired into a child, not fired into an innocent. It takes a special and unique individual to do that, and not everybody's like that. There's plenty of people that raise their hand, take the oath, put on a badge, put on a star, and then they don't realize they don't have it until they're put in that position. And thank God most of us aren't. Thank God. What kind of society would we live in if we were all tested every day like that? So thank God we're not. But it does take a unique individual to do that. Some of us just don't have that, even though we take the oath and we try to make excuses for those people. And, well, folks, I'm a big enough jerk that I'm not making those excuses. If you wear a badge, you wear a star, you took that oath, and you don't have the courage within you to stand in front of my child and take the incoming rounds to protect them and return fire effectively to neutralize the threat, if you don't have the guts, turn in your badge, turn in your star, find a new profession. Yes, I'm a jerk. I appreciate everything else you do in your profession, but you are a warrior first and foremost. And if you don't have the compassionate warrior outlook, you're in the wrong line of work. It's just my opinion. I'll accept the hate mail now and the phone calls if you care to disagree with me. 866-404-6519. Or you can email me at frankborelli@officer.com. Let's get back to SWAT. So after Columbine, things changed. We weren't really sure how it was going to affect what SWAT teams did or didn't do. What we realized was it didn't change how they did things at all. In 2001, September 11, 2001, we had our terrorist attacks in the United States that were aircraft used as guided missiles. And to some extent, that was a learning – it was definitely a learning experience for the country. But it gave us the realistic slap in the face that we needed to pay attention to what we might need to address, what we might need coming. Now, in 2007, we had attacks at Virginia Tech, April 16th, 2007. And we realized that time is so fickle. In the case of the attacks 2007 at Virginia Tech, we had two fully equipped, fully ready to go SWAT teams standing by. Blacksburg and Virginia Tech SWAT teams ready to go in the Coliseum parking lot when Sung-hee Cho started shooting at Norris Hall. And it took them less than two minutes to get on scene, and then they had to breach the building. They had to make entry because he chained all the doors shut. And we realized that no matter how fast we get there, 2 minutes, guys, two fully equipped SWAT teams in 2 minutes or less, that is a phenomenal response. Sung-hee Cho still killed 32 people that day. Time is a fickle wench, and we have to learn to address it. We got there as fast as we could, do what we needed to do. They did. I wasn't there. But you know, there's no risk mitigation there except fast action. We'll talk more about that when we get back on the history and evolution of SWAT.
Want to get your voice heard about law enforcement issues? This is your show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com. And we'll be back with more right after these.
This is Frank Borelli, editor for Officer.com. 152. The number of law enforcement fatalities in 2010. The numbers are too high. Any line of duty death is unacceptable. Join us in Washington, D.C. next year during National Police Week at the first ever Officer World Expo as we combine a unique training opportunity with the largest police memorial in the United States. Visit OfficerWorldExpo.com for details and to join the mailing list. Officer World Expo, because some records aren't meant to be broken.
Renowned and gifted psychic medium, Sylvia Rossi explores the mysteries of this life, the afterlife, and the unseen world that surrounds us all. In the show called Make Contact with Sylvia Rossi, Wednesdays at 2, 1 p.m. Central here on TogiNet. Sylvia Rossi with her special guests and other fellow psychics invite you to call in and make contact with the world beyond and get answers to your questions. Psychic medium Sylvia Rossi has been sharing her gift professionally for the last 17 years. Sylvia has made it her mission to help individuals and families understand their eternal connection to loved ones that have passed on, bringing relief and comfort to countless souls who have been touched by her gift. She's had the privilege of meeting and working with many psychologists who continue to recommend their clients to her when conventional methods have failed. Now it's your turn to make contact with host and psychic medium Sylvia Rossi. Wednesdays at 2, 1 p.m. Central on TogiNet.com. Welcome back to Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com, and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Morelli. Now, let's get back to the show. It's Officer Radio on Officer.com.
All right, folks, welcome back to our last segment of the show today. Talking about the history and evolution of SWAT. Feel free to call in 866-404-6519. Email me a comment if you want, frankborelli@officer.com. When we right before our last break, we were talking about Virginia Tech, and we're talking about how, you know, it's phenomenal. We had two fully equipped SWAT teams on the scene in less than 2 minutes, plus the other patrol officers from Virginia Tech. And as phenomenal as that is, Cho still managed to kill 32 people. I refuse to acknowledge the 33rd casualty that day that was Sung-hee Cho. He's a mass murderer, took 32 lives in cold blood. I am not going to honor his death. I will not revere his memory or any of that. I mean, no offense to his family, but he shouldn't be counted among the grievous dead at Virginia Tech, just my outlook. Two fully equipped SWAT teams in under 2 minutes is phenomenal. Risk mitigation, risk management might have mandated, think about it, if it was just a decade before, things might have gone a lot slower. A lot more people might have died. Cho had enough ammo already preloaded into magazines in his backpack. He could have visited every floor of Norris Hall and put three bullets in every other person in that building, that piece of Norris Hall. The reason he didn't, the reason he put his 9mm to his own head and pulled the trigger, was because SWAT breached and cut his attack short. Time was not our friend in that case, and we need to realize moving forward that time will likely never be our friend again. If we're sitting, waiting, and talking while people are dying, obviously we're doing something wrong. I don't think necessarily every administrator's gotten that message yet. They always want to err on the side of caution, and I understand that. They have to worry about liability management, risk management, budgetary constraints. I get all that. We're out here to protect and serve. We're supposed to be saving lives. If we spend 1 second too long thinking about what we should be doing and that costs a life, we're responsible for it. We have to take the most appropriate, timely action we can to the maximum capability we have within our training. And quite honestly, if somebody has to court-martial me after the fact, so be it. I have to look at myself every day in the mirror, and I have to believe that I did the right thing and not that I hesitated because I was worried about a policy or protocol. So 2007, Virginia Tech changed how we do business a little bit. Now, when we look at how changing how SWAT does business, something else occurred in 2008. And in Mumbai, Italy, there was a set of attacks, a group of terrorists in smaller teams, 10 coordinated attacks across Mumbai, which was India's largest city. And we're now, this is being referred to as multi-attack vectors or multi-attack counter-terrorist action. There's a training program out there, MACTAC. And I'll look that up so I can tell you exactly what it stands for. But again, it's another concern about what we have to do, how we do business, how we respond to potential threats. Multi-assault counterterrorism action capabilities, MACTAC, M-A-C-T-A-C. We have to be prepared. Our SWAT teams have to be prepared for what the enemy might do. And terrorists are the enemy of our country. And one of my biggest fears has always been these people read too many Tom Clancy novels and they take his plans and they go put them into effect. And if you think I'm wrong, there's a book, Dead of Honor, and somebody flew a plane into the Capitol as an attack on our government. Go figure. What happened in September 11, 2001? He's had different books where other attack plans are laid out and delineated. He details out exactly how to make them the most effective in his books. Kind of reason why I stopped reading his books, to be honest with you. But in 2008 in Mumbai, Italy, that's exactly what happened. 10 coordinated shooting and bombing attacks, and our SWAT teams have to prepare for that now. They have to prepare for biochemical weapons attacks, radiological attacks. Friends that are experts, Saberni, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, you know, whatever can go on, whatever's possible that our enemies of our country might have to do or might be able to do, our SWAT teams have to be able to counter it. And that's expanded their mission in a huge way when you think about it. I mean, when you at the bottom line, tactics are tactics. The military skills or the military type of skills that we use to respond to a threat might always remain the same in basic theory. But in application, they might be entirely different. The example I'll give you is cover fire. If you're in the military and you need to move from point A to point B and the enemy's shooting at you, then you have somebody who provides cover fire to keep the enemy's head down. They're not – I mean, if they hit the enemy, great. But the person pulling the trigger to provide you cover fire is merely keeping the enemy's head down so you can move from A to B without getting shot. Well, we can't do that in law enforcement. If we're going into a building where there's active shooters, be it a mall, a school, a business office, or anything else, I can't just spray indiscriminately down a hallway to keep the enemy's head down while you moved up to the next doorway. Those bullets have to be accounted for. Now we have something we refer to as directed fire. Which may very well be necessary. I know for certain it's been used in the past. An officer who fired 21 rounds at a suspect, knowing full well that she was not going to hit him. She was trying to keep him contained in a stairway that was a basement set of stairs so that he could not come out and shoot at anybody. Her actions, because of there was no risk, her bullets were staying in that stairway. She might have hit him, but it would have been justified shooting. He'd already shot at other people. Her actions kept him contained and minimized the risk to other people in the area. That's directed fire, and that's what we're talking about. It's a tactic that now is being discussed or taught or, you know, depending on the agency you're with, what you're doing with it, what you're not doing with it. Those are the kinds of things where we still evolve. Where our SWAT teams are still evolving is to threats like multi-assault, counterterrorism action capabilities, where you have terrorists who come and in smaller groups they perform these multi-vector attacks. Think about in whatever your home city is. Washington, D.C. is the biggest city close to me. I can't imagine how the police departments would respond if there was 10 four-man teams that went and started attacking various locations. Even as armored up as D.C. is now, even as people prepared as people are now, there would be mass casualties. It would be chaos. And God forbid these people do it in more than one city at a time in the United States. And there's no reason to say they couldn't. I mean, coordination's pretty easy. Our SWAT teams have nearly perfected it. So do our enemies. So do our enemies. And our SWAT teams have to be prepared to deal with that. So, you know, along with everything that they deal with, that they have to develop in their training, all of the new tactics that they have to employ, all the new stuff that they have to learn, our SWAT guys still also are, just in their basic training, more highly trained than our patrol folks. Their firearms training is much higher than what you would consider to be average. The local teams that I know of, if you're a SWAT officer, you qualify tonight 90% or better with every one of the weapons, and failing to qualify 90% or better with every one of the weapons means you're off the team. Certainly their physical standards are higher. The physical standards vary across the board, across the country, different teams. The team I am most familiar with, their performance standard is 60 push-ups, 60 sit-ups, 4 pull-ups. They move a ram. I think it's a 40-pound ram, 75 yards. They run 3 sets of bleacher stairs up and down, and then they run 3 miles, and they do all of that in 31 minutes or less. That's their standard. And by the way, they do the pull-ups with their helmet and vest on. Realistically speaking, they feel like that's something they need to be able to do. You have all your kit on. You got to be able to pull yourself up on something. You better be able to do it. That's how they test it. Those are amazing physical standards when you think about it. Some of the SWAT officers I know come close to being in Olympic-level fitness conditioning. It's amazing what they do. And there's no reason for our patrol guys not to aspire to that same level of fitness and capability. It's just a matter of training and time. And quite honestly, some of our full-time SWAT guys, they get paid to train. Because they never know when they're going to have to deal with anything. And the stuff that they have to deal with, it can come out of the woodwork with no warning, and they have to be able to deal with it with no notice. Things like hostage rescue situations, riot control. We don't think about the things that they do that are kind of off the – they're not part of the mainstream media reporting, like perimeter security for visiting dignitaries, sniper and counter-sniper work for that. Barricaded gunmen, barricaded suspects, they've got to deal with those things. Officer rescues or officer down situations, anytime somebody needs a rescue under fire, you're more than likely you're going to find a SWAT APC pulling up, armored personnel carrier pulling up to rescue somebody. It's one of the safest ways to do it. Counter-terrorist operations are big and growing. It's going to become a larger and larger focus. Terrorism's not going away. And their focus is really, we talked about special weapons and tactics. I was having this conversation the other day. We call SWAT officers tactical officers. Well, in a perfect world, every patrolman would be a tactical officer. We would all think about, we'd be careful. We'd be aware. We would plan. We would use good strategy, good tactics, and that makes us tactical. Being tactical doesn't mean you wear blue, black, green, have a thigh rig, and a helmet. That doesn't make you tactical. Tactical is your thinking. I don't like calling SWAT guys tactical officers. Everybody should be tactical officers as far as I'm concerned. But the SWAT guys, they resolve the high-risk situations with a minimum loss of life, injury, or property damage, and they do it through proper planning, higher levels of training, the use of specialized tactics, and their ability to operate a little bit outside the box, if you will, without operating outside of the law or their agency regulations, departmental regulations. Manpower form is probably one of the largest issues. When you look at the big agencies, New York's Emergency Services Unit, LAPD SWAT, DC SWAT, they have the manpower to put together multiple teams. Some places, I know of a sheriff's agency that has about 120 deputies. They have a 12-man full-time SWAT team. That's 10% of their agency when you think about it. I know a bunch of little agencies. When I say little, I mean they've got 12 officers or less. But there's a bunch of them. There's like 15 of them. And they've teamed up to put together a multi-jurisdictional task force. But that task force does nothing but SWAT ops. That's what it's there for. It's a SWAT team put together from officers from different agencies. Memorandums of understanding and mutual aid agreements make it work. So it is what it is. Thanks for being with us today. We're at the end of our show. SWAT's evolution and history. I appreciate you listening. We will be back next Thursday at 1 p.m. And hopefully we'll hear from some of you all then. Have a great day. Stay safe.
Thank you for being a part of Officer Radio, powered by the worldwide resources of Officer.com and hosted by Editor-in-Chief of Officer.com, 30-year law enforcement veteran Frank Borelli. Each week, Officer Radio